Good morning, everyone. Welcome to Talk Louisiana. I'm Whitney Van, filling in for the vacationing Jim Inkster. And on this International Women's Month, I am delighted to have Louisiana's first female attorney general, Liz Murrell, joining us this morning. Good morning.
Good morning, Whitney. It's great to be with you.
Well, I'm delighted to get to talk to you. You've done something that no woman in this state has ever done before. You speak.
Yeah, it was a pretty exciting moment.
You speak to the strength and the power of women. And as we are in this International Women's Month, who's, I guess, motivated, inspired you the most in your career? And who do you look to for guidance and inspiration?
There's so many great women who inspire me. But, you know, I think for a lot of us, it's the women who are closest to us, like my mom, who was a retired history professor from UL. She taught there for 30 years. She helped start the Women in Louisiana, the Women's Studies Collection at UL and the Center for Louisiana Studies. And she's always been someone who I think really just worked hard to achieve on her own and to fight for women. And so she's always been a great inspiration for me. My husband, John, who you know, his grandmother, who I met when she was 93, introduced herself to me as someone who had gone to law school with her husband and graduated in 1925.
That's unheard of.
Oh, it was crazy. You know, I mean, I was a 3L in law school. And she said, well, I understand you are in law school. And I met her in rural Mississippi. They lived in Lexington, Mississippi. And even after she graduated from law school with her husband in 1925, they went back to Lexington, Mississippi, where they lived and raised kids. And she said, I understand you're in law school. I said, yes, ma'am. She said, well, I graduated from law school in 1925 with my husband, and I, you know, just about genuflected in front of her. It was it was amazing that she could have even done that at that time, because remember, women only got the right to vote in 1920.
right. Well, and to talk about how far women have come, of course, you were before the Supreme Court with the big tech censorship case. Tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah, huge case. I think this is one of the most important First Amendment cases that we will ever see, but certainly in the last century, because it really addresses the issue of the big tech platforms and how much government can pressure them to take down speech without the speaker knowing that that's happening. So really, really critically important questions. I think, you know, this debate takes different forms. I was, you know, watching, I don't know whether it was 60 Minutes or 2020 last night, but there was a discussion about this. And the one thing I didn't hear for the entire period was a discussion about how we are supposed to moderate government from deciding what speech is appropriate speech for us to hear or think or say. And, you know, the First Amendment actually addresses that. It says government doesn't decide that. More speech is how we address problems with hate speech, bad speech, you know, speech that may even be untrue.
Do you have a sense of how it went? Do you feel confident on your argument in that?
There were a lot of hard questions that came from the court, and I think the court is struggling to address this in a way. I mean, they always do. These cases go up on a certain set of facts. And our case has some really strong facts showing the sprawling government enterprise to censor protected speech. But what the court is trying to tease out is the question of where to draw the line between encouragement and persuasion and coercion. And that's an important line when it comes to government, because I'm a government speaker, right? I'm the attorney general. When does my speech to you, for example, if you're posting something online or to the platform, really, about your speech, when does that become threatening to the platforms and violate both your speaking rights and theirs? And they've got the whole added complexity of Section 230 immunity under the Communications Decency Act. And that is, you know, how they can moderate content to a certain level, but not become publishers like a newspaper or a radio station.
Yes. Any idea when they'll make a decision?
Usually it takes a few months. I think 2 months at the earliest I would expect, but they go on summer leave. They usually finish all of their opinions by the end of June. So we, you know, at the latest, I think it'll be the end of June, but some tough questions they have to address. And I do think that they usually lean in favor of freedom of speech and the First Amendment. But, you know, it might be hard questions. There were some hypos about doxing and some other kinds of things that have happened to them personally.
Certainly. Well, the phone lines are lighting up. So we are going to go to Patricia. Oh, okay. I'm sorry. We're not right now. Okay, now we can. Okay, great. Patricia.
Good morning.
Hi, good morning. From Magnolia Woods?
Yes, ma'am. I was wondering, when the Louisiana Attorney General brings a case or sues before the Supreme Court, what is the dollar cost for that? Thanks.
You're so welcome.
So the answer to that is very little. It's part of my job. I mean, you know, there are costs to file lawsuits. It depends, I guess, sometimes on whether we're using outside counsel or not using outside counsel. So there can be additional costs for that. But it's part of my job to defend the constitutional rights of the people of our state. And I certainly take that job very seriously when I think that all of our rights, and that's, to me, a bipartisan issue. It crosses party lines when we're talking about the threat to the First Amendment. So part of my oath of office is to protect and defend the Constitution, both federal and state.
Thanks, Patricia, for the call. And now we have Phil in Jefferson Terrace.
Good morning and congratulations. My question to you is, will you protect our public library's right and defend our constitutional rights?
That's a question that kind of requires some unpacking. I'm not sure we can answer it all in this particular segment or in the time that I have, but I can tell you that library boards are created by the legislature. They are local government entities. We did put out some guidance last year to try and sort of address what the legal structure is so that it would help moderate how the debate works within the legal structures that are created around library boards. But, you know, very hot topic, very, very big issue in a lot of places. And I think that at the end of the day, library boards exist to supervise the library. The library has fixed amount of space available to it. And at the end of the day, libraries have been, and library boards and librarians have been moderating the books that are allowed in the library for decades, because it's only a certain amount of space in the library. So I've always kind of asked myself that when we are having this discussion, because everybody's saying you can't take books out of the library. You can take books out of the library. And we always take books out of the library because there's not enough room in the library.
But when they're handpicked sometimes because they don't like the subject matter, that does enter into a different fray, right?
I think that the board, it is the job of the library board to figure out what the guidelines are going to be for selecting the books that are going to be able to kind of stay in the collection. That happens all the time, Whitney. I mean, it happens at the LSU library. It happens in a public library. And I think that, you know, the other part of this discussion that I saw was that there was very little discussion about the fact that most of the push was to have certain content put in certain areas where there would be parental consent, not removed from the library itself.
Another big hot topic. And just briefly, we only have one more minute before we have to hit a break. But when we were talking big tech, TikTok, how do you feel on that issue?
So again, you know, that's kind of the flip side of the whole content moderation debate. TikTok has been sued by a number of states. I certainly have given a lot of thought to that and still may pursue a lawsuit against TikTok for pushing content to minors in like pornography and other content that is extremely threatening, knowingly pushing that content to them in spite of a lot of data that shows what a deep impact it has on mental health for minors. And so that's kind of the flip side of this discussion about content moderation and where the line is drawn. But I do think that they have a legal obligation to look at what their algorithms are doing. We've seen this when these algorithms drive content based on your
right
likes and dislikes.
Exactly. Well, hey, more with Louisiana's first female. Welcome back, everyone, to Talk Louisiana. I'm Whitney Van, sitting in for the vacationing Jim Inkster, and delighted this morning to have Louisiana's first female attorney general, Liz Murrell. She's a graduate of LSU's Journalism School, Law School. She was editor-in-chief of the Louisiana Law Review her senior year and became Solicitor General in 2015. Now our first AG and a self-proclaimed legal warrior. Thanks again for being with us. And if you have a question for our Attorney General, please give us a call. We're taking them. Liz.
Yes.
Oh, good. I just want to make sure you were still there.
I am still here.
What is your next mountain to climb?
Well, you know, we launched a lawsuit last week challenging the LNG pause by the Biden administration, and I think that's a pretty important lawsuit for us in Louisiana. We have a lot of infrastructure built around LNG, and that's, you know, creating a lot of jobs and funding for the state as well. But it's pretty important to us, and we think that it's just part of kind of the attack on the fossil fuel industry. But that attack has a pretty acute, very acute effect on Louisiana. So we think that we know based on the law and what the Department of Energy has done that there's no legal basis for this pause, and that if the government wants to evaluate the effect of LNG export permits, they can do it while they're still issuing them.
For many people not in the legal system, it seems like suits and cases drag on forever. Is there any way to speed it up, get a rocket docket going?
Look, there's a whole rhythm to this, and I think that it kind of starts with preliminary injunctions, which are fast and furious. Sometimes we're defending against them, sometimes we're asking for them. That happens fast, and sometimes that can run all the way up to the United States Supreme Court, and then everything slows down again. Lawsuits take time. I mean, you know, it's not the best way to solve legal problems. Congress and our legislature are better ways to do that. I fully support trying to resolve things through the people that we've elected to represent us. But, you know, when the government exceeds its authority, the only way to really bring accountability back is to file a lawsuit. But it takes time.
Thank you. David, all the way from Atlanta, is calling in for a question for you. David, good morning.
Hi, good morning, and I have a question for the Secretary of State. Governor Landry has proposed.
Well, she's the Attorney General. Just want to make
I like her opinion.
Okay.
Okay. Governor Landry has proposed to reduce the severance tax by 33% on gas and oil, and at the same time, Governor Landry is refusing $70 million to feed hungry children, which is free money from the federal government. So he's given Exxon a big tax break, and he's denying poverty-stricken children, many of them are black, and the Picayune described that. Well, the person who's the Secretary of Children and Family Affairs said it would be an inconvenience or something to that effect for the Landry administration.
Liz, do you want to respond to that?
Well, I mean, I think that there's a lot of apples and oranges there. So they're not comparable. The severance tax issue is a whole separate issue. And obviously, when we cut taxes, we have to look at what the effect is on the budget and whether there's money and a way to either you either cut government spending or you you find some way to supplement that revenue from a different avenue. The issue with I think that was some summer lunch money that comes from the government. I will say this, first of all, those things are totally disconnected issues. And I think that the Department of Family and Child Services has indicated that they don't believe there'll be any negative impact to funding for children in the summer. But there is no such thing as free money. There's not. I mean, this money always has strings attached, and we have to decide. And there's never a whole lot of conversation about this, which I will continue to point out over time, that we always ought to be looking at what the strings are that are attached. There is no such thing as free money.
Well, what are the strings attached then to more funding for school children's meals?
I'm not sure on that particular program. I haven't looked at what the grant requirements are, but I know from my experience in the last 3 years that the administration has put a lot of strings on new grant money. And that it is something that we should always be looking at, because those strings usually have a pervasive impact across our government, and they tie the hands of our legislators and the people who are elected to represent us. So, you know, just looking at them and talking about the strings that are attached is an important part of the discussion every time.
All right. Thanks, David, for your question. And we go to John in Mid-City.
Yeah, I'm wondering how Governor Landry and you can keep on referring to the strings being attached, and yet you never point out what those strings are.
Well, they're different for every program, and, you know, we have looked at some of the strings that are attached in different programs, and I'm not the governor, so it's not my decision or the legislature, so it isn't my decision about whether to take the money or not take the money. My only point is, as a matter of law and policy and politics, we ought to all be talking about what the strings are. There is no such thing as free money, so, you know, that needs to be part of the discussion.
I know that you don't make the final decision, but does the governor consult you on issues like that or members of the legislature?
No, those are policy decisions. They're not legal decisions. I mean, I can assist them in reading the law and telling them what I think some of the implications might be if I'm asked to do that, but I don't engage on the policy decision about whether to take the money or not take the money.
All right, thank you so much. And we have Carol from Jefferson Terrace. Carol, what's your question for our Attorney General?
Yes, given that we've broken records on oil and gas production since the president has taken over, and that last month I checked, and it was the gas prices were the lowest since 1998 for a monthly average.
And I'm sorry, your point, Carol?
What? How can you say oil and gas has been hurt when we got enough to drive the price so low?
Well, so the answer to that is that infrastructure in the oil and gas industry is a long-term investment process. And the policies that have been put in place in the last 3 years are an across the government. Now, you may agree with that policy. I'm not, you know, I mean, I understand people have different opinions about it. I happen to have the opinion that I don't think it's good for our state. But the attack on the fossil fuel industry has been from the Biden administration. They have clearly stated that their intent is a fully across the government approach to attacking an entire industry. I don't think that's a good thing to do, for example, because then they could pick a different industry and try and destroy that industry. But at the end of the day, the oil and gas industry is built on long-term investment. It affects us. It affects domestic supply, domestic demand. The prices may be low now, but that doesn't mean that they will continue to be low. And there are some other legal issues built into this whole question about whether it is within the scope of power for the administration to try and change and remake our entire use and consumption and decision making through the administrative branch of government rather than through Congress.
So you think it is a definite overstep in federal power?
I do, and I've taken that position in a number of cases, yes.
Yes, great. Well, we don't have a few more seconds, but I would like to say thank you so much for joining us. And what can we look forward to mid-year from your administration?
Well, you know, I'm just going to continue to try to do the best job that I can to represent the people and to be a fair arbiter as chief legal officer of the state. But I do love the job. I appreciate the fact that I was elected to serve. And thank you for having me.
I appreciate you, the groundbreaking Attorney General Liz Murrell. And when we come back, the housing industry. To Talk Louisiana, I'm Whitney Van, sitting in for the vacationing Jim Inkster. Signature support is from the Office of Mayor President Sharon Weston Broom of East Baton Rouge Parish. And the show originates from the Investar Tower in Baton Rouge. And live with us in studio, delighted to have McGee Wolf, owner of the Wolf Lending Group, 30 years in the mortgage industry. And it has been an interesting couple of years.
Very interesting.
There were so many homeowners here in our area who got incredible interest rates from 2.9 to 3.2 to 3.4, you know, in the heydays of the pandemic. And it took a pandemic to get right. interest rates that low. But now so many families are stuck with having a 3.2% mortgage, but maybe you've had a couple children since then and needing a bigger house and afraid to leave the rate because they're not historically high. However, compared to where we were,
right,
they seem unreasonable. So what do you say to those homeowners who would like to put their house on the market and buy another one, but they're just paralyzed and sitting around like the rest of us waiting for interest rates to drop? I mean, I really thought we'd see something the latter part of last year, but then inflation reared its ugly head and kept zooming, and here we are.
Well, many, many people are feeling those golden handcuffs, really. Mm-hmm. All they see is the interest rate, and they believe that that is the predominant factor in considering whether moving or purchasing a home for the very first time. I get phone calls all the time, and they just ask me, what is your interest rate? Because they generally don't know what else to ask.
Mm.
And they want to measure the entire opportunity based on interest rate.
So, where is it today?
In the low sevens, high sixes. You know, we have a situation where it's not unique right now, but inflation is the enemy of interest rates.
Mm-hmm.
And if you go back about a year ago, many of us in the mortgage industry were hoping that mortgage rates would drop. And there were predictions that we would have rates down into the fives by now.
Mm-hmm.
But that did not manifest. We've had a few successive poor reports come in with the PPI, the CPI, all those inflation measurements show that we are still in an inflationary time, and the Fed has held off on lowering rates as a result of that. So at some point, rates will lower and get better, and we're certainly looking forward to that. But there is a silver lining in all of this for home buyers if they take a longer-term view of what their options may be.
What does that longer-term view look like?
Well, one of the measurements that we have been able to rely on over the years is that whenever our economy in the U.S. pulls out of a recessionary cycle, mortgage rates definitely drop. It's demonstrable, and we just haven't begun to pull out of it yet. And these recessionary periods are not 5 and 10-year periods. They're usually 2 year periods, maybe three. And so a lot of the prognosticators that make their living predicting on when interest rates are dropping, they're really focusing on that period of time, and it's a moving target. It's very challenging for them to nail it down. It's in many respects an art more than a science.
Mm-hmm. What do you tell this person? 26-year-old first-time home buyer, found a house recently that he's really interested in. However, wants to wait till June to purchase it when interest rates go down. I mean, there's no guarantee, A, they're going to go down, and certainly, B, that a great house is still going to be on the market.
Well, that's the big question. And what we do at the Wolf Lending Group is we try to educate our buyers to make sure they understand the longer-term view. Now, equity in a home is king. What you're experiencing right now is nothing different than supply and demand. Our supply is low. Our inventory is low. But demand is also low. When demand is low, you will have sellers that are willing to negotiate. They're willing to pay your closing costs, or some of them. They're willing to lower their price. As recently as 2021, you may remember, you put your house on the market, and in 48 hours, you had three or four offers, and the sellers were not negotiating, and they were taking the highest offer. In order to win that contract, sometimes you had to offer maybe 10, 15% higher than the asking price in order to secure a home for you and your family. So my strategy is to educate our clients to make sure they understand that there is an enormous opportunity right now. How much would it cost you in your monthly payment to have an interest rate at, let's say, 7% versus 5% compared to increasing your equity, like many of us did who owned our homes in 2021 and 2022, we saw a remarkable increase in our equity. And real estate is the number one wealth creation tool in America. And when you become retirement age, you're going to want to have a ton of equity in your home. So buying smart, buying at the right time, in my opinion, is a lot more financially prudent than only focusing on interest rate.
Well, when we hear a lot of times about people not getting into the market, and they say, you know, I often hear, I'm not because of the interest rates, but a strong objection is, well, you can always refinance. But a lot of people hear that, but they don't know, like, well, what are the costs of actually refinancing? Let's say someone buys a home today and they want to refinance in 4 years when interest rates are a lot better. How many dollars would that cost?
Well, I don't want to say it depends because everybody hates that answer, but you know, a loan amount of $175,000 would not cost as much as a loan amount of $475,000 because some of the costs are tied to a percentage of the loan amount. However, at the Wolf Lending Group, what we do is for our clients is we offer them a no-cost refinance to where we don't charge for underwriting and processing. So those are the fees that come to our company to offset the cost of engaging those professionals within our company to, you know, the man hours associated with that. The way we make our money is when we sell the loan on the secondary market. That's how we get compensated. But I guess a fair number as far as hard costs, because there's a difference between closing costs and prepaid items. People generally lump those all into one.
Correct.
Closing costs are the costs associated with purchasing the home, the appraisal, paying for the underwriter, paying for the title attorney to do the title search and provide the title insurance, which every lender requires. So all of those costs are built into every transaction. And you certainly want to minimize those, but long term, we are telling all of our clients that you will be refinancing. If you buy now, you will be refinancing sometime in the relatively near future.
Yeah, and you know that brings to mind, not only did a lot of people buy new homes in the pandemic, if they didn't buy new, they refinanced.
Absolutely.
And if you didn't and you're out there, oh my goodness, you missed that opportunity. So don't miss the next one. I'm not sure we're going to have one as ever as good as the pandemic, but there are certainly better times than others.
Absolutely. And springtime is a great time to purchase a home. Historically, it is when many, many people get active. But I think it's a mistake to only watch interest rates to make a determination of what is the best move for you and your family when to move. Because there is a tremendous opportunity right now to get, quote, a good deal on a home. In fact, some people are lowering their sales price, their asking prices right now. They're trying to get buyers to show up. And that is one of the ways that you build equity. Buying smart at the right time will pay you huge rewards down the road.
Absolutely. Are you concerned about affordability for first-time Louisiana home buyers?
Yeah, home affordability is a thing. You know, a lot of first-time home buyers, you know, to try to find a home, let's say, at a price point of $250,000 is a real challenge. They're raising a family. They, you know, they want to be in a safe neighborhood. They want to be in an environment where they have good school districts, et cetera. And finding a home at that price point is a challenge. So, you know, in this day and age, you have two income earners in most households. They have to budget. They really have to keep their expenses down in order to afford it, to finding an affordable home. But I think there are many ways of skinning that cat. One of the smartest things that I think a young couple could do would be to locate and purchase a multi-unit property, a duplex, triplex, fourplex, as their primary residence. Have the other units cash flowing. You know, someone else is paying the note on the total loan, if you're smart on how you do it. And that's a way to build equity over the long term. Build a little real estate portfolio for yourself. Yeah. One of the biggest mistakes I ever made was selling our very first home, which we bought for $52,500 that recently sold for about $240,000.
Oh, my goodness. Yes, yes. I know someone who is renting a home, and it was him and his wife's first home ever. Mm-hmm. And, yeah, holding on to those. But you probably needed the equity to buy your next home.
Absolutely. That's exactly what I needed. But if I could have figured out a way to not having to use that equity, get the equity somewhere else to put as a down payment on my next home, God, that would have paid huge dividends.
Well, I hope someone learned from your mistake hearing that advice. McGee Wolf, owner of the Wolf Lending Group. We certainly appreciate you joining us today. It's an interesting market.
No doubt it is. Thanks so much, Whitney.
And welcome back to Talk Louisiana. I'm Whitney Vann, sitting in for the vacationing Jim Inkster. Signature support is from the office of Mayor President Sharon Weston Broom of East Baton Rouge Parish. And the show originates from the Investar Tower in Baton Rouge. We are going to continue our conversation on real estate, affordability, trends in the market, and what is going on. And we are joined by one of Louisiana's most successful real estate agents, Darren James. Darren, thanks for joining us.
Whitney, thank you so much for having me on this morning. I really appreciate that. How are you this morning?
I'm doing great, thank you. We just got off a conversation with McGee Wolf. You know, they have certainly seen a downturn in their market. They've lost a lot of lenders out there, downsizing. I know the real estate industry has lost some agents as well. What are you seeing as far as trends? It seems like we've been in this slump for really a long time.
It is, absolutely. It's been a challenge. You know, when interest rates dropped down to 2.8% and now they went up, you know, we had an anomaly that happened in our market, that something I haven't seen. I've been in the business almost 25 years and haven't seen this ever happen, where interest rates go to an all-time low, really at 2.8% is the lowest that I really saw. And then they jump up to unprecedented highs, you know, 8% almost, and all within a very short amount of time. And so the inventory was depleted, and it just caused a stalemate in the market. But I can tell you what, since January of this year, this market has started to turn around. We're starting to see great things. We're seeing interest rates start to come down. The Fed is slated to drop interest rates again, since it being an election year. And so I see nothing but positive coming for the real estate market moving forward.
Good. I was looking at the trends and the numbers, and it appears that this February is on the, I'm looking at the month-to-month numbers from February.
Yeah.
You know, up a decent amount, not up a lot, but how are you feeling about the comparison?
Absolutely. Yeah, there's no doubt about it. It's definitely trending up. The last 2 weeks have been absolutely stellar as far as the number of calls that we're getting, the number of listings we're getting. I have 4 new listings hitting the market today. So inventory is definitely coming back. It's just, you know, sometimes if you change the way you look at things, the things you look at change.
I love that.
And so we have to definitely be, you know, we have to be optimistic in our ways. And so it comes down to two things, mindset, skill set, and daily habits. And so when we look at how the market's going to shift, we definitely see an upward trend coming forward for the middle part going into the summer, and then also for the last quarter of the year. It's just going to be, I think 2024 is going to turn around definitely a whole lot better than 2023 was.
What's your advice for someone looking at home buying either this month or waiting until May or June?
Well, the thing is that once May and June, you know, the history of real estate and I guess the cycle of real estate in the last eight years that I've tracked it has been like this. So normally it starts in January. January is normally a dead month, and then we move into February. February 15th, things start to bloom. The weather starts to warm up. People start walking neighborhoods, and they're saying, "Oh, you know, Whitney's house is on the market. Let's choose our neighbor. Let's call." You know, Joe and Susie are looking for a house. Let's call them and let them know that Whitney's house is on the market. So February starts to really kick off our things with the people walking neighborhoods looking around. March and April, people get money for income tax. So at that point, they have money for down payments. May, June, July, and August, people are moving for school systems. September is normally a dead month. October is normally a dead month. November kicks off the whole cycle really a strong, strong month in November, just due to the fact that with November being a strong month, people are wanting to be in a new location in a new year with a new beginning. So that's definitely a big deal. So they put the house on the market either in November or put in a purchase agreement in November. They close in December, January, and it starts to cycle all over again. So someone who's looking to go and buy now, I would go ahead and start the process now. Also, you got to look at supply and demand. It regulates everything with every economy. So as more houses come onto the market, right, you got more supply there. So more supply, you know, it's going to affect demand as well. So I would go ahead and tell the consumer, you know, if you're looking to buy a house right now, now is a great time to do so.
Yes. Big in the news, biggest news this year, and some of our listeners may have heard a little bit about it. It's very complicated. So I'm going to ask you to have the enormous challenge of dumbing down the settlement involving the National Association of Realtors.
Sure, absolutely. So, yeah, they made one of the biggest settlements that they have yet, and it still has to be approved by a judge and so forth. So, slated to be final come July. And what it basically says that, you know, normally whenever you have a listing person, you know, a listing agent list a piece of property, put it on the market for sale, in most cases, there is normally two people in a transaction, a listing agent who represents the seller, and a buying agent who represents the buyer. Well, historically, it's been that the seller would pay that buyer agent commission through it. It was basically split. If it was listed with X percent, then it was basically split between the two parties at whatever, you know, deemed necessary. Well, now it's stating that, you know, at this point that the buyer's agents are going to have to step up and absorb the cost of, or actually the buyers are going to have to step up and absorb the cost of the buyer's agent if they want representation in the process.
Right.
So that's pretty much what it is.
Thank you, Darren. You did that a great job. And
thank you. I appreciate that.
And I'm gonna let everyone out there know too that historically the reason for doing that is they weren't, you know, ganging up on the sellers by any means. But let's say that I'm gonna list your property, Darren, and we agree on 6%. Half of that would typically I would give to a buyer's, you know, I'm sorry, buyer's agent. And the reason historically for that is so that that seller gets the house sold. So instead of just having one agent, right, the listing agent, they have thousands of other agents in Baton Rouge who are also trying to sell that property. Is that right, Darren? Right. Does that make sense?
Absolutely. It's power in numbers, right? It's kind of like, you know, you have a sales team out there vying to get your property sold. And with that being said, you know, it's always, I mean, it's always great to have representation on both sides of the transaction. Think of it. If you were going through a divorce, would you want the same attorney to represent you as your spouse that you're divorcing? Absolutely not. You want to have your own separate attorney. You want this real estate transaction. It is the biggest financial investment that most people make over their time. And so you want to have representation on both parties. So it's always in your best interest to have that. And even as, even on the seller's end of it, you don't want someone they're trying to negotiate to get you the most money for the house. You don't want them representing the buyer on the buy side to get the least money for the house. It's a very fine line to walk. So, you know, in retrospect, looking at the settlement and so forth and so on, it's a great thing that's going to happen because it's going to create negotiations on all parties. I think it creates opportunity among the real estate community, but also I think it's in the seller's and the buyer's best interest as well, because you have that sell team out there vying to, you know, work with you to get you what you want, you know, either to buy a home or either to sell your home. And you have all parties collectively, and it's the key for collectively working together to make that happen for everybody involved in the transaction.
You know, nothing's going to change until at least July, at the earliest. But, you know, if you read the headlines, Darren, they're saying that this settlement case could turn the real estate industry upside down and on its head. Do you think that will happen, or do you think that the sellers will continue to say, hey, I do think that I will elect to pay a buyer's agent commission to sell this property?
I think that it will be in the seller's best interest to continue doing things like that. And the reason why I say that is because you, like you mentioned a while ago, you have an entire sales team representing, working that will, you know, potentially have somebody who can buy your home. And you got to think of it from that point of view. There's many different ways to, you know, there's the only time there's an issue with price was in the absence of value. And so you have to explain to that. You have to articulate your value to the seller on why it's important to have that, right? Because there's ways to negotiate to where the seller, you know, still nets what they want to net, and everybody still, you know, makes a paycheck. I mean, basically, you know, they're asking the buyer's agent to go into a situation where they have no idea if they're going to get paid or if they're not going to get paid. So with that being said, it's very important that, yeah, I mean, you wouldn't, if I was working a 9-to-5 job, I wouldn't go work my job at the state not knowing what my annual salary is going to be, or my monthly salary.
Or for free.
Or for free. That's correct. So we have to look at it from that point of view. There's ways to work this out through negotiations to where it's a win-win for everybody involved, to where the buyer's agent gets the buyer gets proper representation from the buyer's agent. The seller gets proper representation from the listing agent, and everybody is a win-win. The seller still nets what they want to make, and the buyer still gets the home of their dreams as well. So there's definitely different ways that you can do that to where it's negotiating, and it's a win-win for everybody.
Thanks, Darren. Just a minute left, but I do want to ask you about the Louisiana Housing Authority for first-time home buyers.
Sure.
What can they expect from them?
Well, I think the Louisiana House Authority, you know, they have many different programs available for first-time home buyers. They have, you know, great opportunities to get in there to get proper education when you're trying to buy your first home. They have different programs, different points of contact in which they can point you toward different people to really help you through the process. It's just a fantastic organization, and highly recommend, you know, if you don't know about them, research them, ask your realtor about them. And just get more involved with them. But they're a great resource for us and a great resource for the state of Louisiana.
Darren James, real estate agent extraordinaire. I appreciate you this morning. Thanks for chiming in on this. It's it's been a weird 5 years in the real estate industry.
Hopefully, it has been, no doubt about that.
We'll get some normalcy back and do it. I appreciate you. Go out there and get them today.
Absolutely. I definitely will. Thank you so much. Appreciate you.
Absolutely. And I appreciate Jim Inkster for letting me sit in his chair today. And I thank you for joining Talk Louisiana.